Welcome to episode 371. Do you find that your mindset is focused on the negative? What's not working? Where you suck? Why you suck? How you'll never amount to anything, or how you don't deserve good things or health, wellness, and success? Well, that's what's called operating on a deficit model of thinking. And in today's episode, we speak with a high-level performance coach about what you can do to begin changing that inner narrative. And it might surprise you to know that it's not all just about thinking really deeply. We also discuss whether performance is even necessary in the oncoming world of artificial intelligence, and how to shift your focus from being a performance-based individual, which is where a lot of us feel like a failure because we don't perform well enough according to our own standards, and shifting that across to being a purpose-based individual. And the practical tools at the end of this episode are something that you're going to be able to do literally today. So if you want yourself, your partner, your kids to get better the right way, then let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Glad to have you on the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast for another whiz banger of a show. Now, for many years, probably to come, but also in the present year, in 2024, it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. Now, if you've lost weight, gained weight, and no matter the diets you've tried, you always end up gaining it all back again or eating too much or sugar binging regularly, and you want to make that stuff stop so you can live in a body that you're happy and confident with, and scroll to the show notes below and click the link to see if you're a good fit for one of my programs so that you can feel healthy, strong, and confident in your own body, just like you used to, or maybe even for the very first time. The link for that is in the show notes below. Now to today's guest, a fellow Aussie and a bloke who has a bit of a name for himself is Mr. Andrew May. Andrew is the CEO and founder of StriveStronger.com and Performance Intelligence. His company partners with organizations to create cultures of well-being in the workplace. Andrew also works with elite athletes and is the mental skills coach for the Manly Sea Eagles National Rugby League team, professional boxers, the Waratahs Rugby Union team, and has previously worked with the Parramatta Eels rugby team. Andrew himself was once an epic athlete as a former middle distance runner and went on to become the assistant coach at the Australian Institute of Sport, and has worked with multiple Olympic and international athletes in several sports. And don't worry, Victorians here in Australia, that also includes AFL. This man has been literally everywhere in Australian sport. Busting the myth that sports stars are just attractive chumps with lots of well-coordinated muscles, Andrew also has a degree in exercise physiology and a master's in psychology. He's also the author of a couple of books and a dad to four children and a fluffy dog named Toby. Andrew, welcome to the show, mate.
Matty, thank you for that lovely introduction. Can I just double-click on two components? Once was an elite athlete. Let's really emphasize the word once, many years ago, my friend. And two, as you were doing that introduction, I thought, is this a recruiting policy? Do you get guests on if I'm one of the 500 people that you want to work with over the next 12 months?
Possibly. Let's make it happen.
Possibly. Hey, it's nice to be on your podcast. You were on mine a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We had a great response. So you really connected with our listeners. So you've set the bar high. So I've got big shoes to fill today.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I want to start with your expertise in simply asking, what is your definition of performance? Because you're a performance expert in all sectors, corporate, sport, you know, all over the place. Like, what is performance?
Good question out of the blocks. You can go and do lots of degrees. You can travel the world. You can read every book and listen to multiple podcasts, including How to Not Get Sick and Die. God, I wish I came up with a more creative name for my podcast, Matty. And it's really complicated. So over 25 years, I've got a fairly simple definition of high performance. It is being the best you are capable of as consistently as you're capable of. It's no point coming out, let's say a real estate salesperson is listening to this or somebody who runs their own business, and you go really hard for a month and you got great cash flow, great sales, then you put your head down, you're delivering it for the next month and you go, oh, shit. Can we swear on this podcast?
Completely.
Okay. Awesome. Feel much more relaxed now. And then month three, you bang into it again. That's not consistent. That's this real up and down, go hard for a little while, drop down. So high performance is being the best you are capable of as consistently as you are capable of. And it's not just one-dimensional, because you could be an amazing athlete, but then an arsehole of a person. Mm-hmm. So I would then go broader than that. It's not just what you do, your craft. It's the relationships you have, the type of person you are, and the impact you have on this planet.
Gotcha. I like that. I like that broad definition, because I think we can all fit into that at some point. But something I was thinking about before we jumped on, and I was trying to think, oh, what am I going to ask Andrew today? What are we going to talk about? And the idea, and this is maybe more obvious to business owners, and there's plenty of business owners in the audience, but also it's creeping into workplaces everywhere, which is this conversation around AI, automating everything and not having to think for yourself and that kind of thing. And so that sort of thought baby produced the outcome of the question that I wanted to ask is, it's a two-tiered question, which is, do you think we're in a performance crisis because of the lack of need to do stuff? And second to that, do you think performance is becoming irrelevant in the conversation where we don't need to perform anymore because AI can do it for us?
No, and absolutely not, with an exclamation mark.
Let's pull it apart. Let's pull it apart.
Yeah, let's pull it apart. So we still need to perform. And what I see with AI, it's not going to overtake. I don't want to be talking to an AI bot podcast host named Randall, and there's no connection, no jokes, no context. So I think there's always going to be a place for human connection. And if you look at evolution, if you're cast from the tribe thousands of years ago, it was literally a death sentence. And one of the defaults we can get to today on our brain, default number two, is FOPO. Dr. Michael Gervais talks about that, fear of other people's opinion. And that's our wiring. So, yes, we've got technology coming in, and, yes, it's changing the way you could research a podcast, the way you write a book. But you still got to bring some personality to it. So where I see AI, and I still do some work with KPMG consulting firm, and I can tell you what the consulting firms are doing backflips over this. Are they going to be relevant down the track? Yes. Where it's information that's batch processing, absolutely AI has a function. But, mate, you still have a heartbeat and you still have emotions and you still have this connectivity, and you can get into all the chemicals around that as well. You're not going to get that from a computer. So I sit here at the moment and say there will always be a space for real conversations and real people. However, you've got to be aware of this and not just sit here and go, oh, it's not going to impact my business at all. Look at what you do. Look at what I do. We would have had 5 staff to do the businesses we do, the work you do with your online programs, with your podcast, with the coaching you do, with the presentations you do. You're doing that with a much smaller team. So, yeah, there's been some real synergies of this, but no, I don't think it's going to be just robots taking over.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, as a result of apps, phones, simplification of the world, which has interestingly led to overcomplication of the world, but do you think we're in a performance crisis? People are not holding themselves to standards. People are maybe weaker than they've ever been before.
Yes, I said absolutely not, because I think the utility still comes back to the person. Mm-hmm. So if we sit here and go, oh, we're all doomed, there's no utility, I have no influence on this, it's absolute bullshit, and you've got that whole defeatist attitude. I do believe, though, we're at this critical point, an inflection point, where we've got to really start to think about, what do I want as a performer? What do I want as a business owner? What are the tools, and when do I use technology? And this actually gives me a lot of work. We now know in Australia the average person is on their mobile phone about 4.5 to 5 hours a day, Matty. Now, different research, so I'm not just pinpointing one, but so aggregate 4.5 to 5 hours a day. That's a lot. Yeah. Well, what do most of your listeners want? What do they want more of? Money,
more Instagram.
Sex, Instagram. Well, what do most people want to have in their day? I need to have more, or the ability to focus or to pay attention.
Productivity.
If you're on your mobile, which has been designed by the whole people who got addicted on the poker machines, and the whole technology behind that, the Stanford scientists understand addiction and distraction. So if you're training your brain for 4.5 to 5 hours a day to be distracted, and then you say to me, hey, I want to focus more, and you're not prepared to do some reps and sets and to actually do some work around that, that's the definition of idiocy. And again, in sport, this is what we're facing against in elite sporting teams. So you just go in there knowing you're elite athletes. And this is the same in the boardroom for the execs and corporates you and I work with. Know that the average person is on their phone for about that 4.5 to 5 hours a day. and they are totally training distraction. They are totally training multitasking and toggling and inability to pay attention. So I think more than ever, we need to bring in these skills and teach people how to use their brain and also how to get that connection. You're not just a head on a stick, but how to use your body to get in that sweet spot where you actually have utility over this. Now, you hear a nerve there. I could talk about that for ages, so I'll draw breath and throw it back to you.
No, that's good. I like it. I like that we're hitting on passionate nerves. But when you mentioned addiction in Stanford, are you referring to Anna Lemke?
Tristan Harris is the guy whose research I've looked at as well. Mm-hmm. He was the whistleblower at Facebook and talked about how the scientists from Harvard went in. And if you think about the old poker machines, you're a young fella with a full head of hair, mate, but I remember poker machines when I was 18. They still had a handle. Yeah, kids, if you're listening to this, your mum and dad, for some of your grandma and grandpa, used to go to the local RSL, RSL or the pub, and you'd actually pull the lever down and then jiggle the knob, and then it got replaced with a button. But if you think about poker machines, if you won all the time, what would happen? You'd get rich.
Yeah, you'd get so rich. Everybody would.
You'd get bored because there's no randomness to it. Now, if you lost all the time, what would happen? You'd go broke and there's no randomness to it, so you just wouldn't go and play. So there's a formula to poker machines and they get you hooked in. They give you just enough that you go, ooh, I'm going to win big on Jewel of the Nile. And that's exactly what they do with Instagram. It's exactly what they do with social media. So when you put up a post, Maddie Lansdale, about the conversation we're doing, and you go back and go, ooh, how many people have looked at Instagram? They are very clever. They'll give you one or two likes and then they hold it back. So what do? You keep going back. And just like you pull the poker machine down, you scroll the screen. It's insidious the way it's been designed. And the science on this, the psychology on this, is so deeply entrenched into our wiring. We're not going to win that war. I just say to people, athletes, executives, any team I'm working with, you are not going to win this war. So you have to actually fundamentally change your behavior. One, understand the mechanism. Two, change your behavior.
Yeah, it feels the same with conversations around sugar and supermarket design and all of the other factors that play into the system being so hard to compete with that, yeah, you have to sort of surrender to, I can't move that billion or trillion dollar behemoth. What can I do in my own reality?
Yeah. Have I told you about the bliss point and research on the Dorito effect?
Oh, interesting. Please tell me more.
Oh, that's right. You were speaking about that on my podcast. Carry on. That's true. Like, you're not going to be what the scientists have done on your taste buds. So you've got to actually realize, hey, I'm going to get off that food or I'm going to look at other substitutes.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess we've got this behemoth, you know, social media, sugar industry, all of these dopamine stimulating things that are distracting us, taking our focus, taking our productivity. Do you find, when you're, you know, working either with athletes or corporates, I'm curious about like the intention or the goal setting process. And is it about reaching and, you know, a sort of a line in the sand of achievement or outcome, or is it about identity shift? Is it a deeper thing like that?
Can you just ask an easy question? Like, you do a podcast and someone will go, oh, do you do mindfulness? And what do you think about pre-performance routines? And you
boring.
Ask these questions that I listen to and then I think I'm going to have to ask him again because I think there's a layer within the layer of this.
Always.
All right, let's get deep back. When you're looking at performance and the definition, being the best you are capable of as consistently as you are capable of. So I spend about a third of my time in elite sport, about a third doing keynotes and podcasts, and a third running my business. But the red thread through all of that is performance. So there is a performer inside all of us. If you set up success on XEX, external, extrinsic, I perform, therefore I am. I win a gold medal, I make the team. We hear a lot about this post-Olympic dip. A lot of your friends, when you train for swimming, went to the Olympics and they think it's going to change their life. A lot of my track and field friends thought the same. They come back, they've gone to the Olympics, they've got the five-ring tattoo on the right or the left shoulder, and then suddenly, oh, fuck, nothing's different. Because the whole identity was about their performance-based identity. Now, to be the best at anything, you have to have a certain amount of performance-based identity. But this explains, Matty, why so many people, and I call it have I syndrome or when I syndrome, when I get the job, when I get the partner, when I get the promotion, when I get the house, and when I get the holiday house, and when I get the kids, and then you get there and go, I'm miserable, I'm rich, but I'm a miserable bastard with no friends because everyone thinks I'm just rude. So how do we balance that out? Performance-based identity balanced out with a purpose-based identity. But somewhere along the line with an athlete, because if I'm talking to an 18 or 19-year-old and I start talking about purpose and legacy, they're going to think, oh, this guy with the shiny head is an idiot. But at the right time, I'll shift that conversation with an athlete that, hey, do you want to keep going on this and have some depth and have some meaning? At the right time, they'll go, yeah, let's balance that out and look at purpose. And we know the research around purpose, Maddie, fundamental three things. Number one, it's got to be bigger than you. Number two, it's got to be future-focused. And number three, it's got to excite the living daylights out of you. So at the right time, the right conversation. So then we get the balance. It's a bit like a seesaw. But there's a performance aspect, because if you're a performer in any domain at the high level, arts, yeah, medium, your music, friends, sport, you've got to be pretty ruthless and dogged to get to the top in it. And if people say to me, oh, look, I want to make the Australian team and I want to have good work-life balance and go to uni and have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and I go, you're absolutely full of it, champ. It's not going to happen. At a period in your life, you've got to be obsessed. At a period in your life, you've got to be totally unbalanced, almost unhinged, when I'm talking world class. But we want to make sure we can balance that out at the right time so you don't have success with all that collateral damage. So, big question. Giving a simple answer, I look at it like a seesaw, and on one side is the performance-based identity. So let's look at how you perform better and what are the benefits of that, and being competitive, that's awesome. And let's balance that with that deeper meaning, or why, your connectivity, why are you here, and having something that excites you. And then what happens long after your role or title as a CEO or MD or athlete or on the team, you've still got an identity.
Good answer. I like it. And it's interesting too. It reminds me of Jimmy Carr, that British comedian, has been jumping on podcasts absolutely everywhere with just phenomenal wisdom, because he's obviously extremely successful. And it's like, behind all of those great famous personalities that are just seem like fun, lovely people, behind them all, there's a savage, right? There's an absolute savage somewhere. And what also I thought about as you were talking there, as I saw somebody speak similar in regards to the Jimmy Carr thing, which is, you know, Jimmy Carr was saying basically, sure, you can have a balanced life, but, you know, the way to win big in this life is to hustle. Like, that's up to you. But if you want a balanced life, then you don't get to win. That's the result of that. But equally, on the other side of that conversation is, I saw a guy speak a few years ago, and he runs he's got this big company and it's got a huge YouTube channel, but he is a parent coach and helps people become better parents. And the metric for their success of each of their parents is that their child does not want to be famous. That's how they achieve success.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love
right. That. But what that leads me to then bring up in this conversation is, with a world of people that are all emotionally stable and don't need very much external validation, then does that drop the standard of performance universally?
Would I have a job if the world was emotionally stable?
same.
Look, it's never going to happen.
No, I know. But it's just that idea that a lot of the drive of performance is usually stories and that identity of validation from somebody particular, a father, a mother that wasn't loving, or peers that I felt rejected by, you know, on those deeper layers. Often stuff like that is fueling that high performance.
It's well known in contact sports, and they've done some research on this in America with the NFL, mm-hmm. that if you get two kids, everything being equal, athletic ability, their skill in the sport, power, speed, so everything being equal, the kid that comes from a lower socioeconomic group may have had a single parent, has had a lot of hardship, I'll pick them every single time because they've got resilience, and they've got grit, and they've got mongrel. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing. A chip on the shoulder will get you going. And this is also linked to that seesaw. Well, on one side, you've got the performance-based identity, and a chip on the shoulder or setbacks, or, you know, you've been told you're no good as a kid, that'll get a lot of young kids going. Or mum and dad did this, or whoever did this. But that doesn't keep you going. That gets you to a certain level and you burn out, because it is hustle. So that, even that word hustle, I think to get successful in career, and this is what I don't like about the whole YouTube generation, hey, we have a wonderful lifestyle. Just do a couple of Instagram posts, do a video. They've got to work freaking hard. Now, the 10,000 hours theory is bullshit. Eric Anders, who actually did the research paper on that, originally wrote that the difference between world-class and good was perfect practice. In a flippant question at a release of one of his books, one of the journalists said, so is there roughly hours on that? He said, look, I can't give you an exact question. He was pressed again. He said, look, It's the practice that they do at the world-class level. It's perfect practice. Yeah, whereas good, just do okay practice. He said, if I had to give you numbers, around 10,000 hours. Malcolm Gladwell double-clicked on that, didn't reference. And if you Google that, there's a whole shitstorm online. So now everyone goes, it's all about 10,000 hours. But you know this, you've worked with people who do 10,000 hours and they're shit. You know, they're still shit. Could be really nice people, but they're still shit. So you can't just say, I'm going to do 10,000 hours and be amazing. An ex-girlfriend of mine, and I'm sure my partner, she won't listen to this because she doesn't like me talking about ex-girlfriends, maybe, but this girl was just phenomenal at multiple areas. Like, she's danced on the world stage. She could speak multiple languages. She could sing. She was a designer. You're thinking, why am I with it? She was also crazy. It's another story for another day. But she could honestly do a couple of hundred hours and be really good. I reckon if she did 500 to 1,000, she'd be world class. So don't just think that it's all just about hours worked. But you've got to get this balance as well. You've got to do the reps and sets. You've got to do the work. But somewhere along that journey, and this is what I love starting with younger athletes and then when I'm working with the squad, the right information for the right people. There's some absolute core basics, but you've got to at some stage unstitch, untangle that. Hey, the chip on the shoulder got me going, but what's going to keep me going is drive. And what's drive connected to? Intrinsic motivation and my core beliefs, which also links to purpose. So sort of coming back to that purpose conversation again.
Yeah. Yeah. How long? I mean, this is going to be a really arbitrary answer because it can only be an arbitrary answer, but how long can you carry the chip on the shoulder? I'm sure people have used the chip on the shoulder to get a really long way.
Some do it their whole life. Some do it their whole life.
Yeah.
And you've got to be a bit careful because there's sometimes a simplicity around just craft your personal purpose and everything's going to be okay. If your backside's hanging out and you're not earning much money, if you're in a shitty relationship, if you're fatigued, if you really are struggling, don't sit down and do your purpose. Just find some activities outside. I call it supplement, not your fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K, testing my old nutrition knowledge, Maddie. But supplement with some fun, some laughter, some play. So it's very much around where are you in your life. And for anyone listening to this, if you feel life's shitty and grey and hard, just put a little bit of joy in there. You know, as you said in the intro, I've got four kids. The biggest lesson that young kids have taught me is they're expansive. Sorry, that was a joke. The biggest lesson young kids have taught me is play. Kids love play. They have play dates, play dough, play time, play school, and they take play lunch. What we do in the adult world is we do meetings. So no matter where you are listening to this, no matter how close or how far away you are to your goals and impact and legacy, add a bit of fun, add a bit of play, and it's going to help you. At some stage, you will get an unlock, and that's the time to go deeper and actually go, who am I? Yeah, what is the purpose? What is something that's bigger than me, future focus and excites to live and daylight out of it?
Do you think at the moment, and maybe this is a millennial, Gen Z and below thing, but you've got four kids, so maybe you've got a really great answer for this, which is, do you think that there's a focus on the deficit? The reason I ask that question is, one, we talked a little bit about it before, but what I'm thinking about is I've very much grown up in this social media world, and for whatever reason, I've found personal development. But it's focused on putting labels on everything, ADD, ADHD, I'm depressed, I've got anxiety. And that's not me saying that those things aren't real, but it's very focused on the tell me why I'm shit so I've got an excuse or a reason to understand why I'm this way. And, you know, maybe some people will be triggered by that, but I don't mind. But like, do you think there's a focus on the what I don't have and what I'm lacking? And is that the wrong focus?
Oh, you're going to wind me up again. How long have we got? Just flash the red light when I've drawn the oxygen out of this conversation. I'll give you a couple examples. This was first tagged, and I didn't even realize when I was watching the movie over 20 years ago, in a movie called Fight Club with Brad Pitt. Have you seen the movie Fight Club?
Yep.
It's a great movie. And for people who haven't seen that, there's a guy who's really struggling, so he goes to support groups. I think Monday night was parents with our partners. Tuesday night was coping with cancer. I think Wednesday night was leukemia. He had none of these, but he was just going to these minority groups to get his fix because focusing on the deficit, getting into some psychology around this, and with the people in that group made him feel better. But I didn't think of anything else. You know, just watched Brad Pitt so ripped. How did he get those abs? Great movie. Didn't see the end coming. And then many, many years later, I was working at KPMG and I'd see what HR was putting out I've got to be careful because I'm still doing some consulting at KPMG, so I'll tread delicately. And it was like, are you struggling? Have you had depression? Are you in a minority group? And mate, I am all for diversity, all for diversity. If you look at my friends, you look at my employees, it's diverse. I've grown up like that. Parents drilled that into me at a young age. But if you ask for problems, what are people going to say? They're going to stick their hands up. So you're getting to it, absolutely. And I see this with a lot of young kids now. You know, my condition is worse than your condition. Mm. What we focus on grows. Barbara Fredericks, a beautiful broaden and build theory. What you focus on, the collective experience, and that experience is what you read, what you learn, who you hang out with, the conversations you have, broaden and build. So if I'm constantly having conversations, Maddie, about what's wrong, phobias, fears, anxiety, and again, there is absolute utility and a need for people to get support around that certain stage in their life. So I'm not being flippant at all. But if you're functioning, and you're functioning well, and all you're focusing is what's wrong, and your friends have got conditions, and I see this with kids, and my condition is worse than your condition, and then you start to look at social media, and then with all the algorithms on that, you look at information, what does it do? You look at a cat, suddenly then you're getting cat videos for the next 10 days. If you're talking the way it is with Google, with a voice recognition, if you talk about something, it pops up on your bloody phone the following day, mate. And if people think I'm conspiracy theory, try it. Get a friend's phone and say stuff like sex, boobs.
Totally. Oh, no, it's 100% happens.
So broaden and build theory, what we focus on grows. And I just pull any hair I've got out just thinking, oh, my God, how do we teach young kids that life is, it's rich, it's complex, and it bounces. You have periods in your life that are great. You have periods that are shit. And then you go through those periods that are shitty, and you know, that's part of resilience and building all that, and you've got a resource network around you. And that actually makes the good times even better. But, Maddie, if we just focus on what's wrong in a deficit model, that grows. So I believe there is a whole bunch of people out there so focused on what's wrong that they're manifesting this themselves. Absolutely.
So picture this, right? Unlocking your potential, conquering emotional eating, and gaining insights directly from a health and nutrition expert such as myself. That's what we do inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group, which is currently free to join. If you've ever felt trapped by food challenges, struggled with maintaining a healthy lifestyle, or yearned for a community that understands the reasons why you've yo-yo dieted for years, then there's a new chapter waiting to be written. And this is your chance to start writing it by joining us all on Facebook Lives, on engaging posts that push you out of your comfort zone and into growth, and Q&A sessions with me. All of this works as a platform to begin changing your emotional eating problems for good. Oh, and also, as a special gift, you'll receive my transformative How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook. And that's also for free. I get it. Skepticism might linger. You might think, Maddie, I've heard these ads and I'm not sure. Well, at least a quarter of the members inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group have been paying clients of my emotional eating program at some point over the last 3 or 4 years. So if you're not sure, you can post in the group and ask to find out if I'm the real deal or not. It's totally up to you. To join us in the free Healthy Mums Collective and to end your emotional eating and feel good in your own skin and begin that journey, pop down to the show notes below, click the link and breeze through 3 simple entry questions. Join today and let's embark on a journey of growth and empowerment. The link is in the show notes below. Yeah, I feel exactly the same.
Did I tread delicately enough on that?
Yeah, totally. If that's where people get attention, if that's where they get their validation, their inclusion, you know, which is like that Fight Club idea, you know, you go to this group and you feel like you belong, you know, it's this conversation around, you know, what's wrong. And sure, that's got its place. Of course it does, you know, like I still see my psych every month. He's a legend. But yeah, if you get your validation and purpose and certainty and predictability and all of those things from that, and that's what happens on social media. You get these people that get these diagnoses, then they accrue these huge followings of people that are like, oh, that's the ADHD chick, or that's the anxiety guy, or that's the narcissist guy, or whatever, you know. And then like, why would they move away from that? Because then eventually it possibly becomes an income source. That identity is now an income source, you know.
And let's go full circle.
Yeah.
It then becomes a performance-based identity, mm-hmm. which is on a condition or a phobia, and I become that as that girl or that guy, or mm-hmm. they. And they're still going to end up with the same problems.
For sure.
Because your whole identity is intertwined with the deficit model that you're going to make all this money and then be miserable anyway. So let's reverse the truck. What can you do on it? There's 3 things you can train. There are only three things you can train. And again, I quote Michael Gervais on this. You can train your craft, you can train your body, and you can train your brain. So any high-performing team, whether it's an executive team in banking, if it's with consulting, if it's with a sporting team, or an individual athlete like a boxer, that I work with some world champion boxers, would just say that it's pretty simple. You can only train three things. What does your week look like? So you can train your craft. So with a boxer, if they start listening to me, they're out, their career's over. If I start talking to Manly Seagulls players about moves and what they should be doing on the field, seriously, their career's over. They've got great coaches for that. And you've got to be really good at your craft. So a musician, someone listening to this, you're a coder, an accountant, we've all got a craft. Second thing you can train is your body. Most people get that, right? You do a certain amount of training, onboarding to get a job. Then so many people do nothing and just check in. We know if you don't use it, you lose it. And if you don't do it, then you're going to get sick and die and go on your podcast for not all the good reasons. The third thing we can train is our mindset. But I pose this question for your audience. In the last week, how much training have you done on your mindset or your mental skills? How much training? Like if you want your body to be fit, fast, flexible, and strong, what do you do?
Might do some meditation, might do some working out, might do some journaling.
Yeah. So if you want your body to get fitter, faster, stronger, work out, get a personal trainer, go to the gym, do reps and sets. So if you want your brain to function in that full range and knowing life is not always good, it's not always bad, but when we start working skills on this, one, we can adapt quicker. The broaden and build theory means the collective sum of experiences. If it's bad, it spirals down. Well, what if we flip that? If the collective sum of experiences is more positive and nurturing and supportive, well, that can also spiral upwards. So doing reps and sets, if you want your brain to be fit, fast, powerful, and strong, you've got to do some mental skills reps and sets. And most people, maybe, and even a lot of high performers don't. They'll go deficit. I'll put it into sporting terms. A cricketer, she walks out into the hallowed turf called the MCG and she's nicking the outside edge. And then the coach says, go see the psychologist because you're not really good with the ball outside edge. So you're focusing on a deficit model. Yeah? Or the rugby league player or AFL player, centre half forward, every time the ball is kicked to him or her, they drop it. Okay, go and fix that because under pressure, when there's the crowd, you're dropping the ball. It's still very much a deficit model. But what we do with mental skills is it's skill-based and we train in a non-pressurized environment. And this language is really important. To get these skills, so to perform better under pressure, to not look at your mobile phone and just doom scroll and think life's shit and to catch up with your friends and try and do the fight club one-off, I've got more conditions than you, you've got to train this. And it's hard. Like training mental skills is hard. I had one of our rock star players at Manly. They said to me last week, because we've now built in at the start of the week, I do 10 or 15 minutes of mindfulness, which I'm just so proud of that the coach and the boys are embracing this because we start the week with an intentional focus. There's 10 minutes of mindfulness, and I'm saying gold standard on mental skills training for elite athletes, which is also gold standard for anyone listening, is you want to be doing 10 minutes a day, 6 days a week. My math says that's 60 minutes. But one of our rockstar players said to me, he said, look, when we're training with a ball, that's fun. When we're training at the gym, we can see instantaneous gains and changes. But when you do the mental side, he said, it's not as sexy and it's invisible. I'm like, ooh, what a great way of teaching. It's an invisible art. It's almost like witchcraft. If I do mindfulness or if I do journaling, if I do deep breath work or if I look at my goal setting or all the stuff we're sort of dancing around, you don't see an immediate gain. And that's why a lot of people just want to double click or, you know, download it. But you've got to do the work on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with so much addiction happening around us with our phones and all of that kind of thing, people are kind of scared of spending time alone with their thoughts, even just 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, what's the opposite of mindfulness? It's distraction. Mm-hmm. And if you're on your mobile phone for 3.5 to 4 hours a day, you're just constantly distracting yourself. Constantly. Yeah. So even just some little micro doses of mindfulness, because a lot of people, Maddie, will go, oh, I'm too busy, I can't do that. I go, okay, what about some mindfulness? Oh, is that esoteric? I go, no, mindfulness, there's a lot of science around mindfulness, and the simple definition of it is being fully present and engaged in the moment without judgment. So how can you, and again, if I get my athletes to do this, I can get anyone to do it, because they're often skeptical and they get tired and a bit irritable, depending on the scoreboard, when they're performance-based identity. But when you're brushing your teeth every morning, average person, it takes 2 minutes to brush your teeth. So what if you started to do this? As you brush your teeth, one, what does a great day look like today? You know, what are the meetings I've got? What are those key performance moments? What is a great way? What does a great day look like today? And two, just a bit of reflective practice. What am I grateful for? You did a minute on each of that and just did that every morning you brush your teeth. There's 14 minutes. It's a much better start to your day than looking at absolute rubbish shit on your mobile phone. So you just start to build this in. And then what if, before every meeting you go into, you build in some of the principles? We talk about a pre-performance routine, which is to really get into the focus before you're in there. What does that look like for someone listening to this who doesn't play sport or play an instrument or work at the high end of the military? What if it's an important meeting? Okay, before you go into a meeting, question number one, who's in the room? Number two, what's the context? Question number three, what does success look like? So you're just bringing your focus and attention to what you should be doing. Again, two little tips, brushing your teeth. What does a great day look like today? What are my key moments? Just a little bit of gratitude. And then that's that window before you go into meetings, just 2 minutes, who's in the room? What's the context? What does success look like? It absolutely shifts the way you connect with people.
Mm. Yeah, I like it. So simple. And yeah, so easy for everybody to prioritize. And I mean, you could just put a reminder or a sticky note on your mirror in your bathroom or something to kickstart that thought every day.
Yeah, but we get distracted and some people be going, yeah, it all makes sense. But does this stuff really work? The sweet spot or the minimum entry point when you're looking at mindfulness is about 6 minutes a day. It's what they call the minimum effective dose. Mm-hmm. The sweet spot is about 20 minutes, but most people, myself included, will find it very difficult to get 20 minutes in one sitting. You know, mm-hmm. I've got that fear of missing out as well. FOMO and FOPO combined mm-hmm. together, it takes a lot of energy. But when you just stack it, and I've seen this, I've done it with so many people, Matty, and they just come back and go, oh, when you said that, I thought you're an idiot. Okay, I get that a lot. But then I just did what you said and did the 2-week challenge. You know, do it for 14 days. And if you still think I'm an idiot, there's been no change to your ability to focus. If there's been no change to your awareness or gratefulness around you, call me an idiot for the rest of your life. And after a couple of weeks, people come back and go, do you know this bird? What do you mean? Do you know in my apartment and there's a busy traffic going by, but I didn't even realize there's a birds because they drop down from just processing, doing, and they start to be in the environment. They notice stuff that has been there, but they just never dropped into it to acknowledge it.
With this mindfulness, this kind of meditative practice, is it just more of the same thing to strengthen that muscle? So, you know, after we get people going, is it just 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, or what else can you do to build on that mental performance or that mental skills training?
Now, I'll back the truck up a little bit because I talk about 12 essential mental skills, and we might have to do another chat another day. We can deep dive into what the 12 are, but there's 3 layers. The bottom layer is more just around self-awareness. So that's self-talk, self-identity, who am I, and energy management. Because if you don't know who you are, you don't know how to control the narrative, and if you don't know how to manage energy, yeah, don't go past go, don't collect $200. Mm-hmm. That mid-level I call state management. That's where you do the mindfulness. That's where you do the breath work. And that's also where we would look at the notion of being calm. Being calm is a totally trainable mental skill. So is being stressed out and having a nervous system or hijacking your central nervous system. So that first level is self-awareness. The mid-level is state management. Then you get up into the pointier end of performance psychology. So then we talk about pre-performance routines. You talk about mental imagery. We talk about focus. Mindfulness is the gateway to focus. Then you look at optimism. You then look at connectedness and you look at goal setting. So, but coming back to your question, if I look at all this, where would I start? Self-awareness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have an understanding of who you are? Do you have an understanding of who you'd like to be? And do you have an understanding of how to unlock or how to leverage the gap between the two? What often happens, and I think I was guilty of this when I first started mental skills, because I thought you've got to do all the technical stuff. And ultimately, what confidence as a construct? Confidence is one, doing the work, two, backing yourself. But I thought I've got to get all to the high end stuff. But no, if you don't have that base level, who am I? Why am I doing this? And for some people, that's uncomfortable because they just want the quick fix.
Yeah,
and then sometimes I'll do that. If I'm working with a sporting team, it's normally group training. We'll embed it into the culture, so it comes from coach down. So it's happening to the athlete without them even realizing. Because one-on-one, you sit down with someone, it feels deeper, more serious and all that stuff. But when I am doing a one-on-one, I'll just ask an athlete, look, what do you want? Like, what does success look like for you at the moment? And then you go to the right tool for that person rather than following. No, you've got to go through step 1 and 2. And so That's what I love about mental skills, but it's also what's complicated. I reckon it's taken me 25 years to have some utility, and I'm still learning so much. So I try and simplify it, but it's actually really complex. And you know this with your training. Some people are much more physiological, you know, so they'll have a bio-awareness. Some are much more psychological, and it's all about schema and thoughts and feelings, and a lot of this is somewhere in between. So then you even get down, do I go a head-down approach, more cognitive, or do I go to bottom-up, which is more physiological, or is it a nice blend of the two? And while we use all these big words, there was a guy, you would have studied, George Engel, back in 1977, who had the biopsychosocial model back in 1977, just after I was born, and thinking, wow, we think all this is new now. I think when Engel discovered a lot of this, just the utility wasn't needed as much because we weren't as stressed, we weren't as hijacked, you know, we weren't as distracted. So I see now mental skills, the utility is not for sport, it's for life, you know, studying an exam, being a normal person to hold a conversation, actually being able to sit in that range of emotions. Well, draw breath, I get a little bit excited.
No, that's good. I'm loving the passion. I'm curious to ask, because you're talking about people being more psychological, more physiological, and you know, everybody's somewhere on that spectrum. Do you find that in sport or any area of performance, really, there's possibly a resistance by either the individual or the coach or the organization because, you know, especially with sport, you're getting these guys really young and they might just be good because they're good. You know what I mean? And it's like, hey, Andrew, don't touch him. Don't get in his head. Don't give him self-awareness because he's a weapon right now. You know, like if he starts thinking deeply and analyzing himself, he might open up all of these doors which become deficits to his performance.
Yeah, and that's right. There's a whole bunch of tools and the right tradesmen use the tool for the appropriate job. It's very much the same when you work in the team. Yeah, there's been some athletes and teams I've worked with over the last 4 years who will have an unconscious competence. And I'll have a conversation with a coach and it's around don't fuck them up. Like honestly, like we'll bring in with a team, it's not just one-on-one. You're actually looking at leadership and behavior change, just a framework. Mental skills is really, you're looking at those psychological skills, mm-hmm. but then you've got to look at belonging and environment, and you've got to look at leadership and the beautiful intersection of those three, it's culture. So you can have a really strong culture and you can teach young men and women about leadership and they can feel like they belong and they can have unconscious competence and just leave them. That is the classic great AFL player, great NRL player, great cricketer, great netballer who goes on to take on the world and then they coach someone else and they're horrible just through this. What do you mean? They don't know what they know. So with that person, Matty, you absolutely leave them. Just go and do what you do. It's working for them, the process. You can overcomplicate it.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
That, however, is rare. Like the absolute world-class rock star who's just so good at their craft and has got such good use or train the body that they don't need to go to the mental side. It's very rare that you get someone like that. But there are some cases I've worked with. You just leave them. Like what they've done, what they've worked out, don't fuck them up.
Yeah. I was thinking too with the deficit conversation we just had before as well, what's the beginning of reorienting the focus on skills that I need to obtain? Is that the mindfulness meditation as the position one? Or like how do we get people out of focusing on what they don't have and being excited about what they can build?
Deficit, as long as it's not diagnosed, and then it's with a trained psychologist, okay, looking mm-hmm. at stress, anxiety, or other conditions as well. Deficit as far as... I'd use more Corey Key's model where you talk about languishing. Now, we know less than 1 in 5 people are flourishing, 18%. We know about some of the research post-COVID, 2 out of 5 people are in that really struggling area. So the mid-range people, we say, just going okay, that acquiescent. So to get that person started, first of all, I would never go to a model. I'd just say, look, what do you like doing? I used to really love 10-pin bowling with me mates, but, you know, get them bowling. Yeah. Where's the science behind that? There's none. But if you can connect with other people and then you get oxytocin, if you can get outside even and you get beautiful fresh air and some sunshine and you talk a lot about dopamine, serotonin and get that nice chemical balance, just start doing some fun stuff. Yeah. Then if I'm getting more technical around the mental skills side, I'd start with something really simple, mate, really simple. Could be some work on breathing. So breath work is one of the 12 essential mental skills. Something as simple, Dr. Andrew Huberman brought this to the world. Our dogs do it. It's the physiological sigh, just breathing in and a second breath. Just doing four or five of those, you can absolutely shift your state. You can bring the heart rate down, and enough training can actually trigger parasympathetic response. So I would teach people some of these skills so they can feel it. And I think the feeling ones, which is why breathing is so good, because when you're looking at some of the more deeper cognition one and some of the self-talk and some of those frameworks, cognitive frameworks, they're a bit deeper. So I'll always go to one of the simpler ones where you can actually feel it and some of the physiological effects. So classic would be breath work.
Yeah, I love breath work.
Then mindfulness, and like they all cross over, because what is mindfulness? It's just being fully engaged in the moment. So you can be mindful and be walking on a beach, looking at the ocean. There's moving meditation or moving mindfulness. You don't have to sit down or be in lotus position. But just build some of these activities into your day-to-day that make you feel good, that make you feel calm, and then just build on it.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. And that's good for people that are busy, stressed, anxious, can't sit still. It's like, oh, you can do this whilst moving. That's a very good entry point.
You do this. So it was one of my take-ups talking to you. You get people to reflect a lot and journal and get more of an understanding where they are before you give them the quick fix.
Yeah.
You know, the 14-day fast, 21-day boost, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure you have all those as well. But I like that approach. And I said that to you when you told me that. And it's really clever.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people I work with, when they're athletes, they're highly motivated. Yeah. Because the team has 11, 15, 18, 13, whatever your sport is. And lots of thousands of people don't go into that. So it's actually much easier for me working with an athlete. Why? The research on psychological skills or mental skills shows it makes about a 20% difference. I say to every athlete, I think that's bullshit. I think that's science marrying marketing, and people try to promote their cause. So meet me halfway. So let's say it gives you a 10% difference. If you say to any athlete, do you want to be 10% better? Absolutely. What do I do?
Yeah, they're hungry for it.
Now, when you're working with a large organization, it's very, very different. So my approach in sport is a lot more structured. My approach in the corporate world, when I'm doing a keynote or we're doing one of our ongoing programs, give them a little taster. Mm-hmm. Just try. Yeah, try. And does that feel good? Okay, great. And then let's do something else and just get them started.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to go too much too soon and overloading them.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Thanks so much for having this conversation, because everybody obviously thinks you're awesome because you're here with me and we're awesome. Where can people find you online? Where are they going to go?
My mum does, so it would be nice for some other people.
Hopefully she's listening.
Yeah, they can go to andrewmay.com or at andrewmay on all the social handles. We've just been bagging Instagram and LinkedIn, and hey, make sure you connect. But I checked with you at the start, so it didn't sound like I was a Demtel salesman or a used car salesman. But we've got a course coming out in the next month to 6 weeks. It's called Inside Job, because I think high performance is an inside job. It's an inside-out approach. So if people go to andrewmay.com/insidejob, you can register for that. It's an 8-week course where I'll coach you through a lot of what we've spoken about today and a whole lot more. The end result of that is for you to have the skills to be calm under pressure.
Fantastic. I'll put all those links in the show notes below. And please, everybody listening, get into Andrew's world. He's a fantastic human, and check out his podcast as well, Performance Intelligence. That's all great content. And before we roll out, I'd love to know, what is one piece of health information you wish more people knew about?
I've heard you ask this before, and I'm the guy training people to be really clear and to be focused, and I have so many answers. I've got hundreds and hundreds. So let's make it context specific and specific to today. We've been talking about your performance and society and where we are and the deficit model and skills model. If there was one thing, I would love kids at school to be taught some breath work. And one of the programs we're running, Maddie, that I'm really excited about, nothing to do with the revenue, but to do with the impact, is we're starting to do some programs with kids. And specifically, one of those inflection points is heading into HSC. So I remember from school that volume equals 4/3 pi r cubed. So if you need to fill up a tank, give me the radius and I'm your guy. But that didn't help me running. And we didn't focus on this at the start. But one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this is I did my best performances in low-key meets, but I didn't know how to manage nerves. You know, I didn't know how to navigate cancer. I didn't know how to navigate a marriage breakdown from an Irish Catholic background. So I think if we can just teach our kids at a young age just that control over their physiology and the entryway, I think, is breath work. Just teach them before an exam, take a few breaths, just soak it in, and then get back to a more relaxed state. And that's something I would love to be taught across all schools.
Fantastic. And I love the little teasers we've just given there about your journey for the next Andrew May installment.
I didn't even do that on purpose.
No, I know, I know.
I'd love to come back. I'd really enjoy what you do. And as I said, after you went on our podcast, I'm really looking forward to exploring more things with you, both online and offline.
Yeah, likewise. Well, thanks for being here. I appreciate you. And yeah, we'll definitely have you back shortly. And thanks for hanging out.
Love today. We'll talk soon.
No worries. Thanks, mate. Bye. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.